Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hey, Tim. Nice to see you again.
Mike, dog days of summer. It's August.
100 degrees in D.C. Welcome to another edition of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. We're joined today by our colleague, Charles Mathias. Charles, could you tell our listeners your practice at Hogan Lovells and give a little background on your prior life in the government?
Sure. Thank you. It's great to be here, even on this sweltering afternoon. It's nice to be indoors. I joined the firm about 8 months ago after 14 years at the Federal Communications Commission. I worked closely with several different chairs, and the job that I left from was as Deputy Bureau Chief of the Wireless Bureau. And while I was there, I did very interesting work. I did transaction reviews. I worked on cybersecurity, the national security aspects that touched the wireless industry as that it was regulated by the FCC. And I was known for being handed intractable problems and asked to solve them. So I like puzzles, and I enjoyed that, but I'm enjoying being here. And at the firm, I'm continuing to try to work in those areas, trying to help people sort of find the pathway between private enterprise and government work. And it turns out that it is a lot of it is in the national security or national security adjacent space. Plus, always going to be doing something with radios, whether it's mobile phones, mobile telephony, getting networks rolled out, finding ways to make networks more secure. One of the interesting things that I was doing at the commission, which I'm now doing here, is working on open radio access networks. I'm very excited about that. I think that that's a new way to deploy networks, which is going to be good both for the operator community, for the U.S. ecosystem, and I think it also will be, it's certainly something that the government as a whole is promoting. So that's another area that's very interesting and lots of opportunity.
So we'll maybe take it at a high level here. In your view, what maybe are sort of some of the top national security concerns in the telecommunications space right now, since national security is the name of the podcast, right? You know, that sort of keep your clients awake at night or that they're coming to you with?
Well, I think certainly the most obvious one is supply chain risk. The FCC's got a certification requirement. They have a covered list, and across the entire national security sector, if you just simply can't use any of the equipment from the covered entities, and it's a list that is common. There's some variation, but it's common across the government, and that's certainly one of the issues. Cybersecurity compliance. The commission has announced a program to give a sort of a rating and a seal of approval. That's an interesting development. I know that's been discussed for a while across the government, but it's interesting and I think potentially very promising that the FCC has decided to take that on. That will be, I think, a lot of work, and I think the comments that come in that proceeding will be very interesting because that's, as a tough topic. And I think deploying more networks is another big issue. And I think people are going to be, I think the government is very interested in making sure that the billions of dollars that are being invested in new broadband networks is also being invested in secure technologies.
So could you talk a little bit about, I guess maybe this is also in your role at the commission and then also here at Hogan Lovells, who are the other stakeholders in government who have a say in sort of the topics you just mentioned? So for example, on the covered list. I'm in the government contracts practice at Hogan Lovells. We have the Section 889 ban on certain Chinese telecommunications equipment and services. It applies to procurements. It applies to grants. It applies to sort of have a funding agreement. It's based in statute. It's from the Defense Authorization Act from a few years ago. But that's a little different than sort of what the statutory regulatory authorities are behind the FCC covered list. So could you talk a little bit about, I guess maybe both the overlap in those areas, but also procurement authorities, including customers like Department of Defense, have the statutory requirements there. And then we have the SEC covered list. So how does the FCC interact with these other government agencies when you've got something like that?
As an all of government participant. And I would put the question back to you. Is there a difference? Because if you look at the billions of federal dollars that are being invested with private entities to deploy broadband, it's a distinction without a difference, I think. I mean,
that's fair. Yeah.
And so I think that's something that people may be surprised about, because I think there are going to be a number of entities that get federal broadband money or federal other kinds of money that may be surprised to find out that these rules apply to them. But I think that they do. The other stakeholders that we would work with at the FCC included DOD all the time. I mean, there's a tension created in particular by Congress to take some of the DOD spectrum resources and repurpose them for commercial use. That's a very complicated process. It requires a lot of discussion, a lot of careful negotiation, and some good thought and technology as well. Department of Transportation, and particularly the FAA and NASA, NOAA. I mean, the FCC plays with all those agencies across the government, because anything that has spectrum in it, the FCC will have an interest, if not an actual role.
And the FCC also looks at supply chain security?
Absolutely. This is an issue that began to bubble up maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and there was a gradual awakening of the vulnerability of our networks to supply chain insecurity. I think understandably, a lot of carriers, particularly the smaller carriers, the service providers, and unfortunately, it's in rural parts of the country where they're sometimes the only service provider, so there's not a lot of flexibility, looked for the best deal. And they found those deals with vendors who are now on the cover list, the FCC. And so, you know, the FCC is reminding people everywhere they turn that this is something they need to take seriously. And there, I think, will ultimately be some consequences. One of the big programs that we were involved with was the so-called Rip and Replace program, which was a mechanism that was set up by Congress to help the smaller carriers get reimbursed if they had happened to have covered equipment on the list. And I think one of the sad ironies of the way that program has worked out is that it's taken a very long time to implement and to actually make the changes, but they're beginning to happen now.
Can you, for our listeners to understand sort of the rules a little more, can you expand a little bit on the FCC's authority there with the rural carriers? My understanding, coming from the government contracts world, you know, where we have Section 889 ban, is that I think some of this was if carriers were using money under the Universal Services Fund or something similar. I think it's called the USF, but I defer to you on sort of how did the whole rip and replace connection and the FCC, you know, helping these rural carriers, you know, how does this all tie together? This is money, color of money from the government, or is it a licensing thing, or is it both?
Well, if the FCC's authority comes, you know, is direct. They have responsibility to regulate both wireless and wireline carriers, and they administer some federal funds, including the Universal Service Fund, and there are other similar funds that are administered. And it gradually came to the attention of sort of official Washington that there were these untrustworthy vendors that were very present in networks in highly sensitive parts of the country. And the decision was made, and Congress played an important role in this, that they needed to have an alternative. And so Congress did create the funding mechanism to do that, and the FCC is administering it.
Now, I would note, as far as I'm aware, for the hundreds of thousands of U.S. government contractors or grantees who were hit by the Defense Authorization Act, Section 889 ban, there's not a rip or replace fund. I expect the drivers were different here, because it sounds like, as I understand historically, you know, for a lot of the rural carriers, this was the best deal on the market. And so they bought this equipment, and they installed it. And it's a big issue to have to replace those with something else. You don't have service when you take those out. You know, unfortunately, the trials and tribulations, I guess, of government contractors or grantees to have to do an equivalent sort of rip and replace is not something Congress, you know, felt there needed to be a fund for. And so that's just been a challenge in industry to go. You have to get that out of your systems in general, you know, if you're going to use federal procurement or grant money. But that's a sort of a whole different ball game than having to rip and replace fund for these carriers who, you know, put this stuff out there all over certain parts of the country. And Could you talk sort of more practical level? This is a question we get sometimes with contractors about replacing the routers or things within my company's system is a challenge, but that's a different situation than literally rip and replace when we're talking about a rural carrier. So could, you know, practically, I'm trying to visualize like what this looks like if I'm out in a certain state in the U.S. What do I have to do to replace all this?
Well, it's typically we're talking about wireless service providers, and you have to, everything from the top of the antenna down to the base of the antenna, there's equipment usually provided. These networks are typically provided by a single vendor. And so from the top of the antenna straight back through to the back office, you have to literally take everything out. And it's been problematic. The rules don't let you upgrade the software that runs your network. The rules don't let you do, you know, any sort of normal upgrades. So these operators are in a tough spot. They are waiting for funding there. And during COVID, it was very difficult to actually get equipment. So everybody's a little bit behind the eight ball. So a lot of activity. And yes, you're absolutely right that, you know, it's nice to get reimbursed, but, you know, some of the estimates about how much the reimbursement actually was going to cover, you know, suggest that there's a significant shortfall, maybe, you know, orders of magnitude. And another thing which is unfortunate about the timing of this is that Congress adopted the legislation before 5G was really a thing. And so the rules require you to replace the equipment that you're ripping out with equipment with the same capabilities. It's a process to get approval to buy equipment which is 5G compatible.
Okay, so if I had a 4G network and I'm ripping and replacing, I could get reimbursed for the 4G. Or 4G capability. But there is a process to, I guess, sort of appeal or get approval to be like, I want better equipment. You know, I want 5G. How does that work?
It's not quite that straightforward as I understand it. And I ought to point out that we didn't admit, interestingly, the Wireless Bureau did not handle the details of this, but I think that you can buy something that is 5G enabled, but not buy it as 5G per se.
Okay. Interesting.
And it could just be a different card that you put in after you get it installed at home.
Well, since you brought up 5G, I'd like to kind of pivot into maybe that in the topic, because you also mentioned sort of cybersecurity. Can you talk about the FCC's role? Well, that's the FCC's role, but also your role today, you know, with Hogan Lovells in terms of cybersecurity of the networks, particularly if we're talking about, you know, 5G networks, we're looking to the future. You know, what are the cybersecurity concerns there about moving on to the next and greatest thing?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about this because there are some people who think that you're adding additional bells and whistles to networks and that's creating vulnerabilities. One of the big sources of debate is with Open RAN, Open Radio Access Networks. And there you have interoperable equipment and you have a virtualized network that all functions in the core. And there's a concern that you don't have one vendor responsible for the end-to-end security, that you have, you know, additional vulnerabilities. The people that I've talked to about this, and these are people who are far more technically proficient than I am and who in whom I have placed a lot of trust, think that it actually is better. And the opportunity to have more eyes on the network components allows you both to identify and remedy whatever network vulnerabilities are identified. So I think that that's good. I know that, you know, people are focusing very much on that. The FCC had a working group on 5G Open RAN security. And, you know, I think it's a topic that every single company is looking at right now. At Hogan Lovells, we're working with clients to try to promote Open RAN deployments. It's been exciting to work with Dish, which has the first 5G standalone network at scale. They have a nationwide network. I think that they've hit a benchmark in 70% of POPs. And that's a huge achievement in a very short period of time. And this is with a technology that, you know, I've heard them say that it was surprisingly difficult to implement in the first instance, but they're sticking to it and they are now beginning to reap the benefits. So that's something to keep an eye on. And, you know, we're working with other clients within the Computer, Internet, and Media group here that are also trying to find new ways to deploy new technologies. Satellite is a huge burgeoning area, both with respect to observation, but also with communications. And each satellite that goes up is more technically capable. and secure, hopefully.
Charles, can you talk a little bit about some of these proliferated low Earth orbit satellite networks, you know, like Starlink and some of the others that are sort of alternative to terrestrial internet?
Well, that's an exciting technology development. The fact that you can, at relatively low cost, have the low Earth orbit satellites basically covering the planet and providing, for reasons of physics and engineering, you know, much, much better internet connectivity than any previous satellite generation did. You know, they are going to be the way that a lot of people in very remote parts of the country are going to be able to get their connectivity. People are doing it now. As soon, you know, there's statistics that show that as soon as it's available, there's a great uptake for some of these services. And there's competition. You know, you've got a number of different companies. You mentioned Starlink. There are a whole slew of other companies that are beginning to get into that space. And I think it's going to be great for consumers.
And then, you know, from a national security standpoint, since that is the theme of the podcast, obviously, you know, been a game changer in Ukraine. And there are clearly other use cases for this kind of connectivity, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's fair to say that the U.S. government has been a significant customer of most of the existing constellations, whatever orbit they're in, whether they're LEO or geostationary or wherever. So I think government also recognizes that the capabilities of these constellations, including the redundancy that they afford, are essential parts of the national security picture right now. We still have to tackle the problem that they don't have the capacity and may never have the capacity of fiber and the fiber networks that gird the planet, but they certainly offer a backup. And I think that's why you see the U.S. government very overtly and, you know, potentially not so overtly buying capacity and getting capabilities in these constellations.
But those are assets that can be held at risk by our adversaries, correct?
Absolutely. There's one of the things that we were beginning to talk about before I left the commission was the vulnerability of satellites and the downlinks and also the terrestrial components. I mean, you can do a quick search on the internet and you can find, you know, very, very disturbing stories about the vulnerabilities that are there, which is why it's so good to have additional capacity, additional redundancy.
And I don't know whether you know about this, can really speak to it, but, you know, obviously, you know, you mentioned that the U.S. is taking steps in this area to kind of shore up its redundant infrastructure. What about our allies and partners around the world? Are they making similar efforts? Or
if you just look at the publicly available information, it doesn't seem like they have as much capacity right now. I think that there could well be a catch-up game that's going to have to be played, particularly, as you point out, in light of what the war in Ukraine is teaching us, and both from a comms perspective and from an observation perspective. I think we know that the People's Republic of China has as a goal to have a very strong presence in the orbits that right now are dominated by the U.S. and other Western companies, and I think that will be interesting to see how that plays out.
They're clearly being, you know, very aggressive in their space program, civil, military, and otherwise. So, and that's clearly an area that is so vital to communications at this point, and for the United States, probably more than any other country.
Yeah, I think that's true. But don't you think that any country that conceives of itself as a strategic rival of the United States is going to want to have rival capabilities? So I don't think we should be surprised that people are moving aggressively to try to create the same capabilities that the United States has. But that obviously is a yellow flag for us and those of us who care about the U.S. national security, because that obviously enhances the vulnerabilities that are inherent in our system.
It is to be expected, but it also demands, you know, that we respond, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think part of what was interesting to watch at the FCC was how, you know, people gradually began, and it was a gradual process because slowly people began to understand that there was a real threat, and the threat was not only on the doorstep, but actually through the threshold and in the living room. And it took a while for that to happen. But yes, at least in my view, you can't just sit there and say, oh, they're developing capabilities equivalent to ours. I think you need to always try to stay one step ahead.
One of the topics that Tim and I have bounced around in the past is sort of like, you know, national security innovation. And the, I guess the way that cuts both ways is, one, like, you know, the U.S., there's way more stuff in there would have been 5+ years ago when we just had Defense Innovation Unit X, because they were experimental for DOD. Now they're just DIU. They've been around. They're doing a lot. And but then there's like, here's the Air Force One. Here's the Space One. Like there's all these things where it's like, we want to throw money at, you know, sort of cool technology ideas, often for small businesses, often for startups, things like that. But that's how you kind of, you know, sort of start this technology accelerator type thing. And then to see, I guess, this thing, Diana is a NATO one. I'd actually not heard of this one. I feel like there's a trend, which is a good trend, that there's more and more like accelerators and incubators and all this stuff in the national security space. Of course, it takes a while to translate from the cool idea to like a working prototype. And we're not there yet on a lot of those. I think that's going to take some time. But I'm excited to see more and more of these, because the thing we face often in the traditional government contracting world is really interesting technology companies see the federal acquisition regulation, the FAR, and the defense FAR supplement, and all these rules and hooks and the rest, and they go, it's just not worth it for me as a company to get involved in the public sector unless there's some other incentives. And folks in the national security space are often motivated by other things beyond just, you know, trying to make the most out of the government contracts, but it does drive people away. And the Defense Department has recognized that, and other agencies recognize that. So even this NATO accelerator looks pretty cool. I guess I'm just spitballing all that, because I find that the innovation piece, I think I find very fascinating, because we're not, it's like the, you know, the stuff that DARPA would have done years ago, and they still do now, to be fair, right? But like, even DARPA is always considered kind of an old-fashioned way to do things. That's why we have DIU. That's why we have these other things. How do you get the cool technology out there for the next thing that we're going to need 5 years from now? Because you can't fund it 5 years later. It's too late. Like, strategic surprise has already been happened because an adversary already spent money on it. So you've got to kind of start this stuff now. So anything that's, you know, seeing more of this innovative ecosystem out there, I find very exciting.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to look into, and this is an unlikely thing that we might be able to do with some of our colleagues in higher education. There, I believe that there is a movement afoot to do a lot more of this research and have, you know, the universities and, you know, higher education institutions are funding research. They have investment arms themselves. They spin things off and they benefit the government, but the funding comes in at the university level. And so they deal with a lot of the problems that you just mentioned. And that's a very exciting development. One of the things, before I was at the FCC, I worked at Lucent Technologies and was able to both wonder at what Bell Labs used to be and then regret what it gradually became, just because of the way the market changed, right? And it used to be that one penny off of every phone call, I think, or maybe 1/10 of a penny of every phone call made in the United States funded Bell Labs. And there was a time when this may be, you know, fictionalized a little bit, but as I understand it, there was a time when the Defense Department would never innovate without touching base with Bell Labs, and vice versa, because Bell Labs was funded by a very significant monopoly. They could afford to just think great thoughts. They could invent hearing aids that were inspired by the way flies hear. You know, they invented the transistor and all those things. You know, I think we're looking for new ways to recreate that. And that's exciting. And I think that'll benefit everybody if we can work it out. I think that the way that innovation has been driven over the past 30 amazing years is probably going to change a little bit.
We are in the midst of, right, and are going to continue on this, you know, communications/information revolution that is lowering latency and upping bandwidth and you know, connecting all of us in new and great and negative ways, and kind of looking out, you know, over the next whatever 24 to 36 months, what are kind of the things that you see coming along, either sort of technologically or in terms of policy, that people ought to be thinking about?
I think from a technology perspective, I think you're going to start to see one of the things that was, which was interesting to watch from the FCC perspective, was that people were underwhelmed by 5G. And I think that's because people put the label on it before you really had the capability. But I think in the next period of, you know, the next coming months, you're going to see 5G that actually has the blistering speed, that it, more ubiquitously. And I think that's going to, people are going to begin to understand what that means with low latency and super high speed, super high capacity. And that's going to be an interesting development. I think you're going to see, there's going to have to be some kind of a truce, I think, between the civilian and defense parts of the government on spectrum use. I think that the way that things are currently going is not practical, and I think it's not good for either part of the government. This is a little tangential to national security, but in a way it's not. I think that the chairwoman of the FCC, Chairwoman Rosenworcel, will probably be under a lot of pressure to look again at net neutrality and try to restore some of what was removed at the beginning of the previous administration. And then I think you may finally begin to hear some real stirrings about what do you do for a 21st century approach to governing communications going forward. I think people talk about it all the time, but sooner or later, the irony of having these amazing technologies regulated under a regime that goes back to the 19th century in certain respects is, I think, that will have to ring true at some point. Politics are politics, and that's going to be difficult. But you already see this in the area of AI and, to a certain extent, privacy. And I think it may be, there may be a movement to try to do something, you know, even more comprehensive at the legislative level. People have said that before, though, and they have proven very wrong.
Great. Well, looking forward to having you back on in 2 to 3 years to... To see whether I am actually getting blistering 5G speeds, because you can certainly count me among those people who are completely underwhelmed by 5G.
Wait and see. Have hope.
All right, I will. Thanks so much, Charles. It's been an absolute pleasure having you join us, and we really appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the hot afternoon.
Same to you.
And Mike, I'll be seeing you on a Friday afternoon soon.
Thanks, Tim. Have a good weekend.
Right. All right. Thanks so much. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.